What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
Welcome back to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. We've got an action-packed episode today. We are covering the recent Supreme Court decisions. We'll be talking about the recent Led Zeppelin case, some celebrity lawsuits, and some other legal news. I'm joined, of course, by my co-host, Jason Whiteside, in studio.
Good morning. How are you, Rich?
Getting ready for the fourth.
Yes, sir.
We're missing our crack host, Sam Penianovich. Where's Sam today? We have any idea?
No, we got to put a tracker.
Yeah.
I don't know. Last time he was stuck down on the south side somewhere, so...
We're going to jump right into our Supreme Court panel. We are joined today by our crack Legal Face-Off SCOTUS team. In studio, we've got Andy DeVote from Loeb & Loeb. Andy served as a law clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and he currently represents companies in complex business litigation, IP, and white-collar criminal matters. Andy, thank you so much for joining us in studio.
Great to be here. Good morning.
We're also very honored to have Professor Carolyn Shapiro from Chicago Kent College of Law. Professor Shapiro is currently on leave from the faculty to serve as Illinois Solicitor General. She is the founder and former director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, iSCOTUS. And she is a former clerk for Justice Stephen Breyer of the Supreme Court. Professor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So very significant term just ended on Monday, very significant day on Monday, in which maybe the most important decisions were rendered. Andy, we're going to talk first about the abortion case that got everyone's attention. Why do you think the court ruled in favor of overturning the Texas ban or restriction, I should say, on abortion in that case?
Sure. So in this case, if you remember, we talked briefly before, earlier in the term, this is a case where there were a number of requirements that were placed upon any facility in Texas that was going to be performing abortions. And two of those that were in focus in this case were, first, that any doctor who performed an abortion had to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of that facility. The second restriction was that it had to meet certain standards that equate to it being a surgical center, a surgical facility. And in practice, the effect of this was there were approximately 40 facilities, and once these were enacted, there were then going to be 7 or 8 facilities in Texas to perform the approximately 60 to 72,000 abortions that are sought every year in Texas. And the reason to answer your question is those were struck down by the court is that 5 justices, with Justice Breyer writing, said, look, first of all, the Fifth Circuit gave too much deference to the legislature in this notion that these laws or these restrictions actually made abortion safer. In fact, there's no evidence to suggest they made abortion any safer, and that the only thing they did was, in fact, that they had the effect of, they didn't go so far as to say that the law had the purpose, although I think that some would say that, but that they had the effect of putting an undue burden on a woman's right to seek an abortion.
So the undue burden language was the key, right? Because that's the test when it comes to any laws that might restrict abortion. Justice Ginsburg, writing in a concurrence for the majority, talked about how abortion at these facilities is actually a safer procedure than things like liposuction, like a tonsillectomy. She was very did you read her decision to be I thought it was very passionate. I thought it was, you know, interesting the way she wrote it. How did you take her writing in the concurrence?
Absolutely. So I think two things. One, she came out of the gate at oral argument. I can't remember if we talked about this before or after oral argument, but she came out and really took charge of the oral argument, asking questions of the petitioner to frame the issue, because she is very passionate about this. And secondly, I think her opinion, it's a great question, because Justice Breyer's opinion was very focused, understandably, on the exact Texas restrictions at issue. And her opinion, I think what it added, at least in my view, is This case may be striking down these particular restrictions, which are in several other states, including Wisconsin. But she was laying, I think, down the gauntlet that any state trying any restriction like this that isn't tethered to actually making women safer is not going to stand under our case law and is going to be found to be an undue burden.
And I think although she didn't speak about the purpose to restrict abortion either, I think that is a subtext to what she's saying. That you can't try to cut back on the availability of abortion by putting in place regulations that purport to be doing one thing, but are in fact in no way advancing that cause.
I mean, in essence, the court found that this Texas regulation that was purported by Texas to further the health of women was actually a sham, was actually an end around to try to restrict abortion, right?
Well, that suggests that the court talked about an intent on the part of the legislature to impose a pretextual law, and they didn't say that. What they said is that there isn't enough evidence to connect the law to the purposes it claims to be promoting to justify the burden that it imposes on women who are trying to seek abortion.
Professor Shapiro, were you surprised by the 5-3 decision in terms of Justice Kennedy being the swing vote? I mean, you know, it was predictable that the four more liberal justices voted in favor of overturning the Texas law, and it was predictable that the three conservative justices voted the way they did. Kennedy was the swing vote. Were you surprised by the way he voted?
I'm not surprised so much that he voted with the majority in this case. Although I wouldn't have put a lot of money on how he was going to vote either way. What I am surprised by is that he didn't write the opinion or he didn't write separately. I would have expected him to write an opinion indicating that he saw this as a pretty narrow question, because in a lot of ways, Justice Breyer's opinion is, although it's focused very much on the Texas law, it has implications that are fairly broad, and I would have expected Justice Kennedy to write something narrowing his view of the case, and he didn't do that.
I agree, and the one thing I would add, I think we both touched on indirectly, is that a really important part about this decision, you know, all these constitutional law cases are separation of powers, like the roles between the different branches of federal government, the roles between federal government and state government, and a really important part of this decision is that the Supreme Court, five justices, criticizing the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, like I said, for being too deferential to the state legislature. On any of these hot button issues, on any of these types of things where they're putting forward laws in these areas, that level of deference, you see that in other cases at the end of the term as well with the affirmative action case, all these different cases. To me, that's one of the most important points, is that fight over the level of appropriate deference to state government.
Does the Supreme Court provide any guidance for the legislature at all, in their opinion, on how they might develop a law? Or do they just look at this as, hey, you enacted this law, we see that it reduced the number of clinics and, you know, availability of women to obtain an abortion, so therefore we're striking it down?
Well, I think to some degree they do, because what they say is you can't simply assert an interest in the area of abortion. The legislature can't just say we want to protect women's health without having some evidentiary support for the idea that the law in fact is doing that, and that in determining whether there's an undue burden, the courts and therefore the legislature have to balance the benefits of the law against the burden. There was a big fight about this level of deference that Andy mentioned in the court. The Texas and Justice Thomas sort of argued that all the legislature needs to do is assert a rational basis, which is the most deferential standard for a court to review what a legislature is doing. And rational basis would be, yeah, we want to protect women's health. And the court said, no, that's not enough, that the benefits and the burden on women have to be evaluated together.
You know, and moving on, we had another case that the Supreme Court decided on. It was the former ex-Virginia Governor Bob McDonald, who had a corruption conviction overturned by the Supreme Court. In this opinion, they focused on the behavior that Governor McDonald had engaged in. And we talked about it on Legal Face-Off before. about what he had done, but he basically arranged these meetings with several businessmen, and the Supreme Court actually overturned his conviction. Were you surprised by that at all, Andy?
Well, he actually received money, right? He received $175,000 in personal loans and gifts from this Virginia businessman during his 4 years.
Yeah, and it was a very interesting opinion, especially with what went on with Blagojevich, because meetings were arranged, money was exchanged back and forth, but the Supreme Court said there were no real favors that were procured by this arrangement.
That's right. So ultimately, having looked at the oral argument transcript after the argument, wasn't necessarily surprised with the result. I think if you asked any of these justices, they certainly don't approve of this behavior. But you see cases like this every several years. We had this in the Skilling case coming out of the Enron debacle. And what these cases are about is you have the court consistently looking at federal statutes. How are prosecutors using these federal statutes? And this is one where, although, you know, Bob for jobs, you know, getting a Rolex and using the Ferrari and all that is pretty unseemly, and his wife getting a new dress and these different things, the question they were faced with was, were the steps that he took official acts? Because it's not a one-size-fits-all. And as a former federal prosecutor, I'll say, you know, we certainly use statutes like conspiracy and whatnot, you know, broadly. And the court is always looking at these statutes to see, are they going too far, even if the acts in this case might be illegal under another law.
And that's exactly what Robert said, right? He said, you know, no one likes this kind of behavior, in essence. I mean, he said no one wants to condone this, in so many words, but the key question wasn't whether that was, you know, good or bad or you know, seemly or not, but whether it fit the definition of official acts. Professor Shapiro, were you surprised by this decision? And I guess before I ask you that question, why is it important? Why does the Supreme Court look to see whether federal prosecutors are overstepping their bounds? Is that just part of the checks and balances of the government?
Well, it is, and there's a principle which the court didn't explicitly invoke, but there's a principle called the rule of lenity, which says that statutes, criminal statutes, should be read relatively narrowly because people should be on notice. People should really understand for sure if they're engaging in behavior that is criminalized. So I think that may be part of what was motivating the court here. I wasn't surprised, but for the same reason as Andy, the oral argument went extremely poorly for the government. But I think that the real debate here has to do with whether or not what the court did is opens the door to more sort of what Chief Justice Roberts called tawdry behavior that many people would like to see be illegal, or whether if it had gone the other way, it would actually make it very difficult for elected officials to serve their constituents, because there are all kinds of things that elected officials do in terms of holding meetings, setting up meetings, arranging to have certain positions just considered by other officials. And they do that for people who may, in fact, have given them campaign donations, which would be included in the law as bribery.
All right. So to that point, what do we take away from this case? I mean, this case was really about jury instructions. I mean, at its base, the issue before the court was whether including these words, merely arranging a meeting, attending an event, hosting a reception, or making a speech, are not standing alone official acts, is what the court said. So is this decision narrowly written so that you can't really apply it to other corruption cases that might be coming up in the future, like Senator Menendez? Or is it broad that you can actually, you know, apply it to other political corruption cases that are either pending or that the government might bring in the future? Andy, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think it's applicable. And I think that when you think, what is this case about, it would answer that with this sort of side note, which is people always want to know, as Carolyn knows better than I, what is the court persuaded by? What do they look to? What you know, and what sources do they rely on? And both in oral argument and in his opinion, Chief Justice Roberts brought out the fact, and I just have the transcript here, he put to the Solicitor General's assistant that there was a brief, an amicus brief, a Friends of the Court brief filed by former White House counsel to President Obama, President George W. Bush, President Clinton, and President H.W. Bush, all former their White House counsel, and to Reagan. And they all said If this decision is upheld, it will cripple the ability of elected officials to fulfill their role in our representative democracy. And so, first of all, as a side note, that's a brief that clearly got the court's attention, because he went on to say, now, I think it's extraordinary that those people agree on anything, joking, lightening the mood. But it goes to the point of that's the balance they're trying to strike, is enabling officials to fulfill their role in our representative democracy, but then not also opening the door that we have everyone behaving like, respectfully, former Governor Blagojevich.
Well, it seems like they didn't have a bright line. It doesn't seem like there's a bright line rule here. It just says that this case and Governor McDonald, there was no criminal intent. It didn't seem like he was, doing anything to further himself but it was more or less to further his acts as governor. But there doesn't seem like a bright line rule for guidance for any future cases.
Well, the opinion talks about a formal exercise of government power, like a lawsuit or a hearing or administrative determination. So it suggests that there has to be some action taken by the official that has some kind of legal consequence in the world in order for it to count as an official act. It's not a completely bright line rule, but I would say it provides a fair amount of guidance.
So, Andy, you mentioned Blagojevich. He is currently serving a 14-year sentence in Colorado. The Supreme Court refused in March, I believe, to review his case. Does he have any hope for having his sentence reduced now, given the McDonald decision? Does it affect it at all, in your opinion?
None whatsoever. I think when you look at the evidence that the U.S. Attorney's Office put together with the many explicit voice recordings, the witnesses, and the case they put on both times, frankly, there's no hope of benefiting from this. I do think, to your good point, I do think what will happen in Senator Menendez's case is that there will be a very long, very careful, thoughtful jury instruction conference with the judge where they will go through and they, all right, government, what are the official acts? Carolyn's good point. What are the steps that have legal consequence that you are proposing? And that judge, that district court judge, will have Chief Justice Roberts. If I were that judge, I would have Chief Justice Roberts' opinion right in front of me. And I would be, all right, how does this fit in with this? Explain to me how this fits in with the Supreme Court's role.
Professor Shapiro, we'll end off with the same question about Blagojevich to you. I mean, do you agree? In fact, Len Goodman, who's been on our show, who is Blagojevich's appellate attorney, said that he agrees with you, Andy, that it will have no effect for a couple reasons, but most importantly because Blago's case didn't involve the official act standard. They weren't contesting the official act, which was the centerpiece of the McDonald case. Professor Shapiro, any hope for Blago sitting in a Colorado jail right now?
I don't see how this case does anything for him. And furthermore, the Seventh Circuit, when they sent his case back for resentencing, indicated that they thought that the things he was convicted of legitimately, the convictions they upheld, were serious enough that it would be within the district court's discretion to resentence him to exactly the same term.
All right. Well, we're gonna get you out of here with one last question. We always are fascinated with our SCOTUS panel on Legal Face-Off, what it's like to be a clerk at the highest court in the land, arguably the highest, court in the world. What's that last day of the term like? Do you pop champagne? Are you relieved? Is there a big party with the justices where they, get crazy? What's that like? Professor Shapiro, you first.
Well, I've never seen the justices get crazy.
there was the wine incident with
Scalia and
Justice Ginsburg.
Ginsburg.
I think the last day of the term, towards the end of the term, not on the last day, the law clerks actually put on a little sort of review for the justices that consists of sort of a musical parodies, and that can be very funny and sometimes kind of irreverent.
Is that on YouTube? Can we find a
that's top secret. Yeah.
Can you sing us a little bit of it, Carolyn? Just a little tidbit.
It's been a long time. I have to admit I don't remember.
That's a good answer.
And if I did, the answer would be no.
Yeah, right. Probably a federal crime to even discuss it on our show, by the way, but go ahead.
But what I remember about the last day was that it was kind of it was sad. Justice Breyer actually left at the court to go to his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, after the final hand down announcement, and that was it. Like although we continued to have lots of contact with him until each of us left our clerkship, that was his last day in the office while we were there, and that was sad.
Yeah, Andy. I agree. It was bittersweet. We definitely our term we had a tremendous number of emotionally charged issues from the same-sex sodomy case, Lawrence versus Texas, the Michigan affirmative action cases, and it was a fight to the end. You know, the Michigan case, I think we had seven opinions. We had the cross-burning, which had seven opinions. Just so, you know, you're definitely sort of excited to have a little bit of a breather, but you also try to remind yourself every day, at least I did, walking into that court, how lucky I was, a kid from Peoria, Illinois, that the Chief Justice gave this chance. And so it was definitely bittersweet because, like, this was my year. This was my time in this special role, and, you know, you're sad to see it end.
Yeah, remarkably similar to my last day as a 7-Eleven law clerk at the DeKalb County State's Attorney's Office. But we're very thankful to our crack SCOTUS panel, Andy DeVote from Loeb & Loeb, loeb.com, and Professor Carolyn Shapiro, the Illinois Solicitor General and the founder of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. She could be reached at kentlaw.iit.edu. Thank you very much. We'll see you the next time there's a Supreme Court issue.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
About halfway through our show here on Legal Face-Off, Action Pack episode. Please remember to follow us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, The Legal Face-Off on Facebook, perhaps, we think. Follow us on Twitter, and tune in to our show on WGNplus.com. We're next going to cover the Led Zeppelin verdict that came down last week. We're joined in studio by our resident intellectual property expert, Gene Hoffman. Gene is head of the intellectual property group and a little firm, I think we might know it, called Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Gene, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thank you.
We're also joined in studio by a surprise musical guest. We will not disclose who that is yet. We're going to leave that as a surprise, but it's very relevant to our discussion. So, Gene, we're talking about the Led Zeppelin case that got a lot of attention. Tell us, first of all, what the backstory to that case is. Why was Led Zeppelin sued?
Well, the backstory to the case is the plaintiff in that case was the estate of a now-deceased musician, Randy Craig Wolf. He was with the group Spirit. They were a 1960s psychedelic group. And the case against Led Zeppelin was for copyright infringement. The plaintiff there alleged that Led Zeppelin infringed the copyright, Randy Craig Wolf's copyright, and a song called Taurus that was on a Spirit album from the, I believe it was the late 1960s, and that the song Stairway to Heaven infringed that work.
So, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, what is the standard on an infringement case? Because we've covered these before where the Pharrell lost on the Blurred Lines, and that's up on appeal right now as far as copyright. So what is the standard that the court looks at to determine whether someone has infringed on the copyright?
Sure. The plaintiff in a copyright infringement suit has to be the owner of a copyright and an original work. And there's basically two things that they need to show or prove. One, that there was copying, that their work was copied. And the second is that there's a substantial degree of similarity between the two works in question. So that's the basic standard. Now, on the copying aspect, was it copied? There's sort of a sub-element to that, which involves whether or not the defendant who's allegedly copied had access to that earlier work, because if you had no access to it, you never heard it, you couldn't have copied it. And without that element of access, there isn't copyright infringement.
So to that point, Gene, Robert Plant, who is a defendant along with Jimmy Page, he was actually called to testify in the case. He said he didn't remember being in the club that night when Spirit performed it, even though the plaintiff had noted that he and Page had shared a concert bill with Spirit at one point. Now, listen, I'm not surprised in the 70s Robert Plant doesn't remember something, let alone where he was. But how important do you think that testimony was in convincing the trier of fact to find in favor of Led Zeppelin?
Well, it's important because, you know, as I said, there has to be some access to the work to have copied it. And usually there isn't direct evidence of access. So what they try to do is show whatever circumstantial evidence that they have. So whether or not, you know, Page or Plant were at a concert where this was performed would certainly be a piece of, you know, circumstantial evidence that they had access to the song.
So, Gene, you represent a lot of artists, a lot of musicians. You know, we've seen Jason reference the Pharrell and Robin Thicke loss in the Blurred Lines case. It's common for musicians, and you're related to a musician, to borrow maybe music from other sources. Where is the line drawn between, let's say, a musician being inspired by another artist and outright intellectual property violation? And, you know, is it easy to make that distinction?
Well, you know, and that's where you get into the second part of the analysis that I mentioned, the substantial degree of similarity between the works. So, and it's really, you know, there isn't a bright line, black or white. You just basically have to listen to them and, you know, see how similar they are, compare, you know, the notes, the chord progressions, and so forth. But, you know, and a lot of musicians will, as you said, maybe borrow or be inspired by things which are pieces of music, maybe things that are in the public domain. And if that's what they're, you know, they're all doing, if both, you know, the plaintiff and defendant, if their music had elements of things from the public domain, then, you know, neither one of them could claim to own the copyright in that particular, you know, part or piece of the music.
Well, I'm a huge classic rock guy. I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan. I consider myself a Leadhead myself. What was most disturbing to me about the trial was when Jimmy Page, after being questioned by the plaintiff's attorney, said that the influence for Stairway to Heaven was not this Taurus, but instead Chim Chim Chimmery from Mary Poppins. Seriously? That's what your inspiration is for one of the greatest rock songs of all time, Mary Poppins? That, to me, is the most insulting part. But let's turn to our musical guest. Gene, who do we have in studio with us today?
This is my son, Chris, who is a musician and actually our marketing assistant this summer at another firm that we're all familiar with.
Yes. Chris, welcome to Legal Face Off. So what we're going to do is have you play us the two different you know, tunes, but don't tell us which one is which. Let us decide which one we think it is. It's also important to note that our producer, Mike Heidemann, is intimately familiar with these issues. Mike, tell us about what's going on with your opinion on this.
You know, I think that it's a really interesting case, the fact that after all these years, this is when they've been compiling all this evidence and stuff, and now they're going to break it out to be against Led Zeppelin. I've heard both versions of the song. They are very similar, but at the end of the day, I mean, how many notes can you make? There's only 12 notes in the American Western version of music. So, I mean, it's a really interesting case, and I'm all for Led Zeppelin.
Mike Heidemann not only gained fame as producer of Legal Face Off, which is, you know,
it catapulted
the most,
his
most important
to,
job.
He's got his own podcast now.
Also co-host of WGN Plus music podcast Sound Sessions. Right? That's your co-host on that, Mike?
That's Kevin Richter, who is also Bill and Wendy's producer here at WGN.
Yes, it all comes full circle. So, Chris, let's start playing the mystery tune. You're not going to tell us which one this is. We're going to guess after you play the two. So let's have at it.
Sure. All right. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Here's your first mystery tune.
Of a buzzer.
Yeah, I know.
All right, that's number one. Let's hear number two. Thank you. Does anyone remember Laughter? All right, so for me, it's a no-brainer, personally. The first one is clearly Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah.
And now the second one is Taurus. It sounds a little similar, but I mean, for me...
There's a few chords that are missing, too, out of it, the second one, but...
Right? Were we right? First ones?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the main thing that I hear is Stairway is a lot more complex, obviously, as you noted, with the chords. Both are basically like a descending chromatic riff in A minor. So
I was going to say the exact same thing.
Yeah. So basically, they're just changing the bass note as you go down. It changes from A to A flat to G. And the part that really sounds the same are the first three notes, which are basically just an A minor triad. So if you can copyright that, like...
I think it gets back to Mike's point. I mean, there's only so many notes and chords, you know, that you can... I mean, eventually there's going to be crossover and everything.
Mike, even a close call for you as a musical expert?
I'm going to say this one is close. I'm going to have to go to the judges for this.
Really? Close? Mm-hmm. Gene, so the jury heard exactly what Chris did. I mean, Chris wasn't the expert in that case, but they would have heard the two tunes, correct?
Well, actually, they heard musicians... playing the songs, I think, on piano and then also on guitar. And that was actually one of the issues in the case that the plaintiff was complaining about, was that they didn't get to actually play the song for the jury. And part of the reason for that was they had registered the copyright by registering the sheet music for the song, not an audio performance. So that's what their copyright was registered in, basically in the sheet music. So they were only allowed to present someone playing off of the sheet music.
So going forward, we'll get you out of here with this question. Going forward, do you think that the Led Zeppelin verdict makes it easier or harder to prove that your song has been copied, or is every case stand on its own? I remember some of the most famous examples are Ray Parker, who wrote Ghostbusters, sued Huey Lewis, alleging that I Want a New Drug copied it. There was the recent case with Sam Smith and Tom Petty were actually, Sam Smith acknowledged that it was similar and Tom Petty signed off on it. Do you think it'll be, you think we'll see more of these lawsuits?
I think we'll see more of these lawsuits, but, not because of, the decision that the jury came back with in this case, because, I mean, every case is obviously going to be different. There's different songs, you're comparing them. But I think part of the reason you're going to see more of them is because, this was a suit where the estate of Randy Wolfe is suing, a good 40 years afterwards. And part of the reason for that is because copyright actually lasts lifetime plus 70 years. So you see a lot of the heirs, the estates that own the copyright. And there's a three-year, the statute of limitations for suing for copyright infringement is 3 years, and that is like from the infringement. Well, with something like, Stairway to Heaven, there would be an infringement happening, still to date, every time the song is played, every time another, copy of it is sold. So you really have this, you can really go back a long way and still have the right to pursue these infringement suits. I think that's the reason why we'll probably see a lot more of these suits.
All right, favorite Led Zeppelin song. Let's go around the room. Mike, let's get the lead out today on We're going to get the lead out on WGNplus.com. Favorite Led Zeppelin song on a Led Zepp Thursday? Mike Heidemann.
Absolutely, without question, I love the song The Ocean by Led Zeppelin.
Chris?
Definitely Black Dog, one of the best guitar riffs of all time.
Gene?
I'm going to go with Stairway.
I'm going to take the cop out, too, because I don't know that many Led Zeppelin songs.
I got a million, but Going to California is my jam. Mm-hmm. Gene Hoffman, Chris Hoffman. Gene is with Bryce Downey and Lankoff, head of the Intellectual Property Group, BDLfirm.com. Chris, you got a website you want to plug? What's the name of the band?
No band at the moment. I'm kind of between gigs.
Yes, between gigs. Waiting for the LSAT results, yes?
Actually, just got them the other day.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Oh. Good?
Yeah, it was good. It's better than I thought it was going to be, actually.
That's good. Worst decision you've made. stick with the music.
Look at us. You don't want to be like
play
that.
Us out on WGN. Give us another little Stairway to Heaven. Coming up on Legal Face Off, we've got the legal grab bag. Thanks, Chris and Gene.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off on WGN Plus. We're next going to cover the Orlando shooting and the police reaction to it. We have Chief Jim Bierman from the Police Foundation. Jim is the president of the Police Foundation, which is a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting innovation and improvement in policing. It is policefoundation.org. Jim is also a former police chief, was a member of the Redlands Police Department for 33 years and retired in June 2011. Chief, thank you for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN Plus.
It's my pleasure.
Chief, you have talked about the police reaction to the Orlando shooting. Do you think the police got it right, or were there any things that they should have done differently?
Well, my understanding of what happened in Orlando is based on media reports, what I've watched on TV with the horrific video and accounts and watching the press releases or the press conferences that the chief has done. And based on that, I believe that the police in and around Orlando that responded to this did absolutely the best they could to try to control a very violent situation and appear to have followed all of the best practices in American policing that deal with active shooter situations and hostage situations. In order to answer that more definitively, obviously, I have to read police reports or interview some of the officers involved. But by everything that I think we know at this point, at least publicly, they appeared to have done an exceptional job. Having said that, a lot of people lost their lives. And I'm sure that even the Orlando police may look back and say there may be a few things that they could have done differently or better.
All right. And you,
that is the nature of these kinds of things.
And you've spoken about, too, how Columbine in 1999 was kind of an impetus for the SWAT departments across the U.S. to change the tactics on hostage situations. Can you just walk us through what it was like pre-Columbine and then post-Columbine?
So prior to Columbine, the thinking in the United States was that when you had an active shooter situation, the first responding officers would surround the building where the incident was occurring. You wait until the tactical teams, the SWAT team showed up, and then they went in and dealt with the guy. And the problem with that model is that while you're waiting for the SWAT team to show up or more officers to arrive to help you, people inside are being killed. And that's what happened at Columbine. Since then, the team and the best practices are, and I think this is true all over the United States, is that when you get enough officers at the scene, and that could be one or two officers, you go in. If there is somebody actively shooting people, your job is to stop them as fast as you can, and that means you go in. And then with very few officers, and sometimes it's going to be a single officer, it depends on what's happening at that moment. So that's a radical change from what happened prior to Columbine.
So why didn't they do that in Orlando? Why did they wait 3 hours?
So they didn't wait. So this is a misconception. The Orlando case was really two incidents kind of contained within the first one. So the first was the active shooter piece of it. The off-duty officer that was there engaged the shooter instantly. Nearby officers responded within just a couple of minutes. They engage him, and they go into the nightclub. And that is consistent with all of the best practices. They engage him in gunfire, and there's a gun battle going on. He retreats, as I understand it, into the back of the building, into a bathroom, and takes hostages, and then begins communicating with him. At that moment that this transitions from an active shooter situation to a hostage situation. And that kind of a case, the tactics you'll use are very different, especially when the hostage taker is talking to you. Because what you're trying to do is get him to calm down, ultimately release the hostages and surrender. If you continue after him, you're likely to precipitate his shooting or execution of the hostages.
And in fact, to your point, the reports are that the officers thought that the shooter had strapped some explosives to some of his victims after a bomb robot had sent back images of a battery next to a body, right? So that underlines, I think, your point that it would have been maybe dangerous to storm in, not knowing if there was any risk to the other patrons of the club.
Exactly, and that's what I was about to say, that at some point they believe he may have had explosives. You know, and this is not a perfect science. I mean, this is these are very fluid situations. They're full of stress, and the officers and the command people are making split-second decisions based on what they know and what they think is best to try to save those people inside there. And you just don't want to precipitate an explosion or the shooting of these people if you can help it. But at some point, they determined that he was about to harm those people, and that's when they breached the wall and they went in after him.
All right, and it's easy to Monday morning quarterback and dissect it, but from what you're saying, there were two police officers and an off-duty that engaged the shooter initially. Is that what you said?
Well, there was an off-duty officer that was providing security there. The news reports are that he engaged the shooter almost immediately. Then there were officers nearby, and coincidentally, several of them were SWAT officers. It's just SWAT in that agency is a collateral duty to other officers. So they'd be patrol officer most of the time, and SWAT immediately. And those officers responded, and I think there were five of them. And they engaged in the gunfire and went into the nightclub, pursuant to the best practices, and had a gun battle with him inside there, and that's where he retreated to the bathrooms.
All right, and Chief, how long will it take for the whole analysis, just of the police department and SWAT team and how they functioned, to get a conclusive report for you guys to study and learn from?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on what they want to do. So I think the chief has said that clearly there are lessons to be learned here. The Orlando Police Department appears to be a very sophisticated police department that understands that they have an obligation to the rest of policing in this country to share the lessons learned. It is very typical for a critical incident review, an incident as complicated as this, to take 2 to 4 months once it begins. I don't know if they've started such a review or if it is their intention to, but I would be very surprised if, based on the chief's transparency and apparent desire to tell the public what happened, if they would not do that. I'd be very surprised if they would do that.
Chief, last question here. We'll let you go on Legal Face-Off. In the wake of these kind of shootings, you hear a lot of people in the media, in the public, in the Twitter sphere talking about, well, if I was in the club, I would have done something to take this guy down. You know, he's got to reload at some point. How could someone not have acted? What's your feeling on that? I mean, is it prudent for the general public when faced with an active shooter situation to try to confront the shooter? Should they gang up on him? What should they do when confronted with this kind of situation?
Well, yeah, so I think it's very important for people to think about what would happen if I was in that situation. I don't think it's beneficial for anybody to criticize the action or inaction of people there because they weren't there. I mean, you just don't know what you're going to do until it happens. I think what makes a lot of sense to me and what I tell people about this is that the city of Houston put out a video that I think is very instructive. And it's called Run, Hide, Fight. And that three-part piece tells you what you should do. That if you can, you get out of there as fast as you can. If you can't get away from the shooter, then you try to hide. And if you can't get away, you can't hide, then you fight. And you just don't let him execute you. You've got to try to fight for your life. I think it's very problematic to criticize people that don't do one of those things when they're faced with something as horrific as they were faced. I think people there did the best they could to protect themselves, to try to avoid this guy. But, you know, they were going, they were under stress, like we can't believe, and they were, you know, experiencing something almost nobody ever experiences. But I think it's instructive for people to look at that and say, if I was there, I couldn't run, I couldn't hide, I am going to fight that guy. I think that is a very healthy response, because unfortunately, I don't think this is the last one of these we see.
Chief Jim Bierman of the Police Foundation, policefoundation.org, thank you very much for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus.
It's been my pleasure.
Finally, on Legal Face-Off, on an extended version today, we're going to get to the much-copied, never-duplicated legal grab bag, where we tackle some of the hottest and most important legal stories in a quick fashion. First, Jason.
First up's Volkswagen. They've settled their emissions lawsuit. We covered this before on Legal Face-Off, where they doctored the computers in their diesel engines to show that they burned cleaner than they did. So the government has reached an agreement with Volkswagen for $14.7 billion, which $10 billion will be used to compensate owners and get these faulty vehicles off the road. They actually have to scrap all the vehicles that are taken back and give the owners. The range is, I think it's between $5,100 to $10,000 is what each owner gets for diminished value on their car, and then they get additional money to buy back the vehicle. So expensive lawsuit for Volkswagen.
Yeah, largest ever civil settlement for a car company, and very importantly, the settlement doesn't represent any potential criminal liability for the company. The Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates said on Tuesday that I could assure you that our criminal investigation is active and ongoing. So this will end their civil exposure, but
as we've seen before, I mean, the criminal exposure for the CEOs, the government's picking up on those. So.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, exactly true. They might go after the individuals responsible for this. Speaking of exposure for car companies, Anton Yelchin from Star Trek fame was killed when his Jeep Cherokee didn't stay in park and crushed him against his gate. What's going on with that?
Well, there's been a recall issued for the vehicle's transmission gear selector, where it can mistakenly be... The driver might think they leave it in park, but they don't. And this is what happened in his case. They think that he put it in park, got out to check the mail, and the vehicle was really in neutral and rolled back and crushed him against a brick mailbox. So there is a recall that the National Highway Transportation Administration has issued for this car. This was prior to the accident. So I'm sure there will be some more litigation because of that.
That's now sparked a class action lawsuit against the Fiat Chrysler Corporation that was filed late last week, that accuses the manufacturer of intentionally covering up fatal design flaws and deaths from the defects.
Jason, car manufacturers don't ever do that.
I mean, how much are you just licking your chops over there to try to get after? Have you ever sued a car company?
Yeah, we have about two going on right now. They're not easy cases. They're long and drawn out, and they take a while. Litigation's, 3 to 5 years.
Just one of these cases, and Whiteside is gone forever from Legal Face-Off.
No more Legal Face-Off.
Off on a beach somewhere.
You got it.
Next up on the legal grab bag is everyone's favorite TV judge. Who's your favorite TV judge, Jason?
I don't remember her name because they're all on when you and I are working at 3 p.m., but I forget her name now.
Gene Hoffman, favorite TV judge? You got one?
The only one I know is Judge Judy. Is she still even on?
She makes like $50 million a year, too, as being a...
Chris, are you too young for judges on TV?
You know, Judge Judy was my jam back in the day when I was young, and she was on at like 2 p.m., and my grandma would watch her.
Judy was a hard, hard ass.
There's a Hispanic woman on now that I forget her name, but...
Yeah. Mike, any favorite TV judges?
Judy's great. Judge Joe Brown is a pretty good guy, too.
Well, guess what? Yeah, Judge Joe Brown is now banned from practicing law in Tennessee. Under an order from the state Supreme Court, the judge has been placed on disability inactive status, which means that he is temporarily disabled and incapacitated. If he proves to the court that his disability has been removed, he can get reinstated. But unfortunately, the judge is suffering from complications from type 2 diabetes.
I love that defense. Suffering from complications from type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, you don't buy it?
No, I don't know. His rant was pretty out of control in the courtroom.
Well, I miss my guy was Wapner. I can't believe no one mentioned Wapner, the original TV judge.
Something like the 70s, right?
I grew up. Well, it was the 80s.
That's what you had in Canada, right?
Easy.
You guys are 10 years behind.
That was the original People's Court. And you had Wapner, you had the bailiff, Rusty, and then Doug Llewellyn. Actually, now the guy used to be the guy from TMZ,
Harvey
Levin. But the original commentator was a guy named Doug Llewellyn, who wore like these amazing three-piece polyester suits.
Very quiet, soft-spoken.
Yeah, and he always ended off with some advice that I remember to this day. He said, if you've got a dispute, you can't resolve it, don't take the law into your own hands. You take them to court. The people's court. Ba-dum-bum. So
that's when it clicked that you
that's
be
what
an
a
attorney.
Young Rich Lankov in Canada decided to follow Doug Llewellyn and become a lawyer. Next, we've got more problems with Johnny Manziel, a frequent subject here on Legal Face Off.
He's keeping the news alive.
But his attorney did something perhaps ethically questionable, Jason?
Yeah, you know, it's a good lesson to all of us, too, in the day of social media that maybe you should back off when it comes to your clients. The attorney, Bob Hinton, who's an associate with the law firm defending Johnny Manziel, sent out a text to the Associated Press that he doubted the former Cleveland Browns quarterback could remain clean while seeking a plea deal in his case. He also texted a receipt, supposedly from Johnny Manziel, indicating that he may have spent more than $1,000 at a drug paraphernalia store less than a day after he was reportedly in a hit-and-run crash. So,
Listen, when you have Johnny Manziel as a client...
That's not smart to begin with.
But I think it's smart because look at all the work you're getting, right, from Johnny Manziel.
Yeah, but is he going to pay? I mean, the guy doesn't have a contract anymore, so...
Yeah, but he said he texted the words, heaven help us if they ever drug test... heaven help us if one of the conditions is to pee in a bottle. So he had to resign from the case. So, yeah, be careful.
And that could be an ethical violation, too.
Absolutely. Another story that got a lot of attention this week was Kanye West in the news. He released a video. I think he released it at the forum. People actually paid money to go watch this video. It's called Famous, and the video has a bunch of celebrities nude in bed. Some celebrities are Legal Face-Off subjects, including Bill Cosby, Taylor Swift, his wife, Kim Kardashian, is in bed, George Bush, former president. And it's unclear at this point whether these people are actual, whether it's their actual likeness or whether, whether it's their likeness or actual photos. And at the end of, or at the end of the video, Kanye either says, or I think he tweets, he says, sue me. He's actually threatening people to sue him. So there's been a lot of discussion this week about whether this creates a cause of action for the people depicted in the video to sue over using their likeness.
He truly has lost his mind.
Yeah, Absolutely, but on the other hand, look how much publicity he's gotten from this in a week. It's, you know, unbelievable amount of free publicity. But because we've got our intellectual property guru in the studio, we'll ask Gene. Do you think that George Bush, do you think that Taylor are A, going to sue him, and B, successful over using their likeness?
I don't know if they're going to sue him, but I certainly think that they can, and they'd have a pretty good cause of action, because that actually what he's done is he has infringed their right of publicity. If you're a celebrity, you are someone that has the right to control your own publicity. If you're doing something for commercial gain, which certainly Kanye was here, I think they have a pretty good cause of action against him.
Now, he would probably argue, his lawyers would probably argue that this is a parody, right? And parody, the laws are a little bit more liberal. The question is whether the public would confuse the parody to be real, right?
Well, that is the standard, whether there's a likelihood of confusion. So certainly that would be, part of his defense to the case. I think that they've got a good shot at a case.
Kanye needs you. He needs a new attorney.
I won't even go around the room and ask for your favorite Kanye song because I can't name. Mike probably knows some Kanye.
Oh, yeah? Absolutely.
Yeah. Have you seen Kanye?
Have I seen
you him? Go to a lot of concerts, I know.
I have, and I do need to
Oh, wait, you had that... you almost saw Kanye recently in New York. Tell us about that story real quick.
I flew all the way to New York just to see Kanye at the Governor's Ball, and he actually did not even show up.
Boo.
Tried to do a 2 a.m. show, a pop-up show, which he's known to do. Didn't show up for that. They had to be shut down by the New York City police. But I must say that the best concert I've ever been to was a Kanye West concert in Milwaukee. So
wow.
Well, when was that?
That was about 6 years ago.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Finally, talking about athletes in the news, athletes in trouble. Dallas Cowboys star wide receiver Dez Bryant is being sued by his landlord, Jason.
Yeah, you know, Dez Bryant has done pretty well over the last few years. He stayed out of some trouble that he initially had when he first came into the NFL. But he's being sued for damages between around $60,000 for a house that he rented and destroyed. They said the walkthrough of the place revealed irreparable damage to the carpeting, flooring, windows, shutters, and blinds. Animal feces were present, along with trash debris and personal property inside.
Sounds like another weekend of the Whiteside Estates.
One big party. Not the animal feces.
That's a little much.
But anyway, it was a house that was rented for Dez Bryant's mother. So Dez Bryant in legal trouble again. But this time it's at least not a criminal act.
Want to thank all of our guests today on Legal Face-Off, Gene Hoffman, Chris Hoffman, Chief Jim Bierman, Illinois Solicitor General Carolyn Shapiro, and Andy DeVote from Loeb & Loeb. Follow us on iTunes. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Want to thank our crack producer, Mike Heidemann. Maybe we have a replacement permanently for Sam Panianowicz now that Mike is...
Who's Sam?
I know. Who's Sam? Good luck, Sam, with whatever you're doing. Instead of being with us on Legal Face-Off, have a great 4th of July. Jason, we in Canada just call that Sunday, but I'm sure you'll be enjoying it. Chris, you want to play us off with a little impromptu Star Spangled Banner? Is that in your repertoire? What do you got over there?
On the guitar? Yeah.
Yeah, why not? Let's see. Putting him on the spot here.
Don't got it.
You got any national anthems? You got Canada, maybe? Or
Canada.
No.
I'll sing it for you. Oh, Canada.
There you go.
That's all anyone knows.
Exactly.
Our home and native land.
See you next time on Legal Face-Off.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.